Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you all enjoyed your lunch and had a lovely meal. We're going to be starting off this afternoon's proceedings with Andy Clean. He's going to be talking about the kernel hacker generation and the community that's associated with the kernel and how it's changed over time. So, Andy, it's all yours.
Thank you. First of all, there's about multiple generations, not only a single one. I just want to stress that point. But, okay. First, I must say, the Linux kernel has been around for quite a long time, I think, since 91. And I haven't actually been around in the Linux kernel for that long, like some other people have, like Linux or Ted or so, but not me. But I've been around for quite a long time, and I've been watching the people who are working on it for a long time, and I noticed that, for example, at specific times there were actually new people going into the Linux kernel and writing new code and basically appearing and doing new work. Other people were disappearing, and I was always sometimes thinking about in like a generation of kernel hackers, because often the people who are new up here at some time they're doing something similar or they're looking similar and so on. And I actually first I was thinking, because I remembered some name and so on, actually doing some data mining on Linux kernel, mailing list archives and so on, and giving them names and dates and data, hard data. But then I figured out, actually, I don't like data mining very much, because I'm not actually NSA or Google. So instead of giving you actually dates that I get from mailing list archives, I'm just giving you some trends as I notice them. And I must say, my memory is not perfect. So first, it's more newer trends than older trends, simply because older trends I don't always remember. And of course, always only the trends I see, not more general trends. And it's also the trends, as I give them, are not necessarily temporary order. So I still give you various generations. I call them generations still. They're not actually generations, but more trends. But I like the name generation, so I kept that. And there's the ordering of them is not as they appeared in time. So actually, as I talk about them, this is not, you cannot say it happened in that order, but there's a little bit of overlap and so on, but it shouldn't matter. And as I said, talking about new stuff more than older stuff, but some older stuff is also present. So more, let's say more from the last 3 years than before that. And one first thing I want to talk about is the janitor generation. It's an interesting one. Basically, like when you have Linux kernel is a very big project with a lot of source code and so on. And generally, when you have very large software projects, then they tend to need a lot of maintenance, because over time, specific items that you use in the source code change or things like that. And normally, like in commercial development, it's actually often not much time to do cleanup, because commercial development is often very focused on only getting releases out, getting features out, but nobody's actually doing the cleanup. And Linux kernels always had more luck with cleanup, because there were people volunteering that. But at some point, there were some people like Arnaldo Mello or Rick von Hill, who actually defined, made a new graph to get new people for new kernel developers, which they called the kernel janitors. Basically, a kernel janitor is a newbie developer who is not really, doesn't know enough yet to do a big change or a big new feature, but just they know enough C and enough programming to do a small change, small cleanups and so on. And there was actually a mailing list that also called kernel janitors and a website. And they recruited people and they did lots of changes there. And they actually had quite a lot of new developers in that. Of course, they mostly did simple changes, like for example going over the source code and clean up the code in simple ways and so on. But there was actually quite a lot of changes coming out of that. And one thing what happens first is, for some cases, for example, you're doing a change, for example, you're replacing an obsolete function call with a new one or things like that, and you actually often generate a lot of changes, a lot of patches, because usually it's not manageable if you do a single patch which does all these changes, because it conflicts with other patches and so on. Usually what they do is generate lots of small patches that change, for example, one driver and change another driver, to the various maintainers and so on for them to merge. And originally when it started, we still had some trouble there with merging patches, like that right now the infrastructure works great. They can actually, the Zinc kernel group can actually merge patches very quickly. But at this point, we always had what we call merging bottleneck. So there's actually sometimes patches got lost, or it's simple, the infrastructure for the release, for getting the releases out, couldn't handle that many patches. But now it works mostly to Git and some other changes, like various very great people who are doing the work and so on. And so kernel janitors over time did a lot of changes to the code. And actually what they're doing basically is keeping the code clean, like a janitor does, because janitor keeps care of the house, and kernel janitors keep care of some code, of small parts of the code. But one problem I see with the kernel janitors in general is there's not really a process to coordinate them to more complex projects. Because the idea basically of kernel janitors was to start with easy stuff and then get them to more, help get them later to do more complex contributions. But currently right now, we seem to have some people who get stuck, for example, as kernel janitors, or that are not helped enough to do more. But maybe it will change in the future. We'll see what happens there. Okay, another generation that happened some time ago, this was what I call a login name tree generation. At some point, we had various people, various kernel developers, who actually had an own tree of patches. This was based on the login name. For example, we had the AA tree. Actually, AA is standing for Andrea Arcangeli. It's not his login name. His login name is Andrea, but it's often the login name. Anyways, basically what happened there, when we still were in the merging crisis, means that there were more patches on the mailing list than the Linux kernel could actually merge, then often patches wouldn't get merged, or they would drop down and ignored and so on. So what happened is that people were actually, some kernel developers actually did some changes on their own, they also merged patches and then released trees based on their login name, and then other people used these trees. Like, for example, the AA tree was from Andrea. He first had all the changes for his memory management work he did, and then a lot of other changes. Actually, the AA tree, at least for doing the 2.2 kernel, was at some point the de facto 2.2 kernel, because at least several distributions were shipped based on it, and lots of people were using it, because the standard 2.2 kernel were just too slow merging the patches. And the AC tree from Alan Cox was also similar. At some point, they had a lot of changes, and were going in and later. Anyways, and we had an trend at some point, because then a lot of other people were also starting to do their own login name trees, and it became quite interesting. We had quite a lot of releases, release mails all the time on the kernel that said, the blah blah tree is released now. I think it didn't actually work to have that many of these trees, because basically to make these login name trees useful, you actually need enough users for them, because they're only useful when they actually get tested and then later when the patches are tested in the login name tree, they get merged into mainline, because then you can say, okay, it has been tested there and some users found it good and usable. But if you have too many of them, then the user base is better, the tester base cannot keep up with them, because they can usually only run one of them. So, but it worked at the end, I would say. I think some of the smaller ones basically died off. Right now we don't have many of these trees anymore. Mostly I think they got replaced by one big tree, the MM tree from Andrew Morton. But we still have some smaller trees, but from various people. And of course, what we have is, for example, the maintainers of various features still have their own trees for stuff. Usually, for example, there are things like the PowerPC tree or the doc device server tree and some other things where people were the maintainers doing their work or merging the patches into that one, and then get into. But the problem is usually people don't want to run single feature branches, don't want to test them. Because if somebody wants to test something, they want to have a tree that does lots of things. They're usually not interested in only a single feature. So the more topical trees get now pulled in the big tree, in the MM tree. And but we also have as different trees are the distribution trees. And I found it quite interesting, because at some point, basically, that there's so many trees at this point that it showed that there was a problem there. And then eventually it got resolved basically when the patch infrastructure was, for example, first with Swift Keeper and then with JIT was improved to merge more patches. And eventually many of these trees disappeared again. But it was interesting. And it's not interesting the people who were doing these trees, because I personally had never had a login name tree simply because I was too lazy about this. I always release a new tree. But I found it interesting that many people were motivated doing this. Okay. And then another generation that appeared basically, I think around 2000 it started, something like this. And suddenly Linux became big business. Before that, of course, there were some corporate users, but usually there were just people who were solving their specific problems. But at some point, we had basically companies deciding, okay, Linux is a great thing, and we invest money into it, into development. And they were actually starting to pay people to work full-time on specific things they were defining and so on. And it was quite interesting for the current community because suddenly they had a lot of new developers going in, basically appearing out of nowhere. Often even people who have been working on other operating systems for a long time, like all Unix people and other people and so on. And it was quite interesting because it was a little bit of a culture clash here, how these people learn to work with the main kernel. And the first thing, of course, that there are different kind of companies who want to contribute to the kernel. The first thing is hardware vendors, which just want to have the drivers in. So usually what happens, they write a driver, and then, or they write a driver for Linux, and then say, okay, how do we merge the driver? How do we get in mainline? How do we get in distribution? What they usually do, they first try to talk to the distribution, and then the distribution say, but we don't want to maintain the driver for you. We want to get it into mainline first. Then at some point they learned to get the patches into mainline first. And there were already some changes here. Then the next thing that we had, for example, what they called the hook people. So basically at some point people were starting to do some various features on top of Linux. And often what you got there in Linux kernel was they were asking, okay, we have this great thing that we want to do, and we don't want to put it in the standard kernel yet, but we just need a hook there so we can do it. So for example, basically when you are a standard example of hook is, for example, LSM, where you have various security modules that can be plugged in, or hook is NetFilter, where you can do all kind of advanced firewalling on top of it. Or then there are people who wanted, for example, a special accounting, so they needed this special hook in the context switches, and actually not in the context switches, but in task creation, so they can keep track of tasks and all kinds of other stuff. And there was always a joke because we get so many requests for hook because Linux is so popular now that a lot of people want to do things on top of Linux. So that if there's no throttling with the hooks, at some point there will be more hook code in the kernel than other code. So I'm not sure it will happen. It's always interesting because basically often when people want to have a hook, it's actually necessary to talk to them first because usually they want to do things completely separate, but often there's a much better solution that doesn't need the hook or that does extend some feature that's already in the kernel and so on. Anyways, there was a quite interesting education process of people who wanted to add hook. And one thing that also happened from the commercial people, for example, we had several bigger companies who say, okay, we had this other operating system before and, you know, porting some features from the other operating systems there. For example, a big company with three letters was very big on that one, but also other companies. And it's actually interesting because often they develop big patch then, the complete QA and everything. But they did complete patches at some point and posted them, and you got a big patch, but then said, oh, it's actually not how we want to do things. Yeah. First of all, I'm pretty annoyed because they already put so much work into it. And then another problem is if you got a big patch, you actually need somebody to find somebody to review it. And when you want somebody to review it, you need first somebody to be interested in you because reviewing is a lot of work. And often we had cases, for example, that when there was not enough interest in the community for a particular feature, they would actually, your reviewer, so people would post patches or point up the patches, say, okay, this is a great feature that we would like to have, but then they weren't very good at hyping their feature, and then it wouldn't actually get merged. For example, my standard example on this one is eProbe versus kProbe. eProbe, if anybody knows it, was an early attempt by IBM. It originally originated on OS2, I think. Basically, it was something, a way that you can load little scripts into the kernel and it can measure things. For example, basically what now SystemTab and kProbe are doing. And they had these great patches for doing them and for posting them, but nobody was interested in them. So in the end, they basically died off because they just figured out if there's no interest, we cannot merge them. And the funny thing was, what happened later, a few years later, then there was suddenly from another operating system, from the last, a big hype about dtrace, and everybody was saying, oh, dtrace is the big killer feature and everything, but dtrace is basically the same thing as dprobe. So if we had basically had the review bandwidth, or if they had managed to attract enough people to review the code and merge the code, then and dprobe had been merged, then Linux would have had a feature that's very similar to dtrace several years ago. And this also happens with quite a lot of other features. So there's actually, basically we had this problem that the people the commercial people weren't basically not good enough to sell their stuff to the mailing list so that it actually get somebody else does the work of cleaning it up and merging it. And another thing, okay, so this earlier already, they first developed the stuff in a closed way and delivered an initial create patch. And it's actually quite different because in Linux, normally in commercial and closed development, usually what happens is some developer is assigned to do some code and then they do the code and then maybe they find another person to review the code which is assigned to do this and then they check it into the source control system. But in Linux, it works like this. Basically, you write code and then you publish it on a public mailing list. And then you need to attract some people to review it and so on. And say, yeah, I like this, or I don't like this, or basically you need to publish it, and if you're a new person, okay, if somebody is already established, then people usually tend to look at it, or it gets easily merged because the maintainers like it, but if there's something new, then basically you need to attract some attention from people, so they actually look at it and work with them to make it, because usually most of these patches need some changes to be actually mergeable. So, the publishing model is actually quite different. I think there was a big culture shock for some of the commercial people. And what I said earlier already, the submissions often were very lofty because of that. Because basically they were just throwing the patch on the main list, but they weren't very good at actually getting people to look at it and so on. So we lost a lot of stuff there. This is often compared to the TCP when you're basically losing a packet, and then some people would do a retransmit a few times, but actually in this case, you actually have to do a little bit different and maybe send smaller patches first or describe actually why you want to do the patch and so on. But finally, these problems mostly resolved, but were not better, I think, at educating new people how to do this. And a lot of companies learned how to do this properly. For example, kernel mailing list, they want to have attention. The kernel mailing list is very annoyed if they just get thrown something that they haven't never heard of before. So, for example, it's much better to first send some early patches that are not perfect yet and then basically improve them and so on. For example, a standard way I think Chris Mason says this first, a good way to solve a problem, even if you don't know actually how to solve the problem, is to write a completely crappy patch and then send the crappy patch to the mailing list and then wait for people to improve it. And eventually people will improve it, will generate a good patch, and then you have a good feature that you can merge and so on. And tricks like this basically had to be learned. And for some companies still have problems with merging stuff, but it's a lot better now. I think basically what's still a problem is when some groups are writing a lot of code, then the review is a problem, because basically you need a lot of work to do actually code review, and code review is very important for Linux. And we don't have the bandwidth for that. So that's one issue with commercial people. But anyway, the next generation, I want to have, I call them the Russian mathematicians. I must first say, they're not actually all Russian mathematicians. So I just found out that a lot of them are either Russians or mathematicians or both. So I found it was a catchy name. And there was especially some people there, for example, people will recognize who I mean with that one. But basically, they were at some point, some very clever people appeared on the mailing list and were starting to do changes. And they were really, really good changes. And there was really at least one person who people suspected that it actually was a group of hackers acting in a single name because he was so productive at some point. But of course, not all of them are so good. But basically, we got some verified people which appear in mainlist and do very good changes and solve tricky problems. And that's actually quite good because over the time, the kernel got a lot harder. For example, one big thing that is very complicated right now is when you're doing SMT scaling or MT scaling, and you have lots of problems with memory ordering and lockless data structures, which is sometimes very hard to solve. Then we are always glad if you have some very bright people who can solve these particular problems. For example, some of the races in there are very hard to look, very hard to find in code. And so if you have some very bright people that they have, but in the end, I actually hope that we don't need them anymore, because as the saying goes, debugging is twice as hard as writing the code. And when somebody has to be really, really bright to write some code, and then nobody else can debug it anymore, maybe then that you cannot debug it anymore. So actually, the ideal what we'd like to have is that you have much simpler code that doesn't need a genius or a very bright person to actually write or look at or debug. Because then, even if you have to debug it later, then even still a normal person, or maybe a bright person, with code that has been written by a normal person, and a bright person can debug it, or hopefully even the normal person can still debug it. So in the end, I hope that basically we can make the infrastructure and so on, the kernel, simple enough that, for example, even for MT scaling and so on, we don't need these kind of people. Anyways, we're still glad that we have them. And then another generation that we're getting recently, at the flame generation, I noticed that, for example, that the tone on the mailing list are sometimes getting more and more nasty. What I noticed, for example, is a lot of people act very different when they are an email than in person. For example, I found out cases in the past where I was actually first read somebody's emails, and I was very aggressive, and I thought, oh, what a nasty person. Hopefully, I will never meet him. But then, at some point, when I actually met them at some conference, and I found out that they're completely different in person. So some people seem to have basically problems with, they don't restrain themselves in emails as they do in person. So, and we, of course, always in Linux kernel, or always in the internet, you have flames, so where you send somebody a nasty gram, which you probably shouldn't have sent, and so on. But I somehow get the feeling that the tone gets a little bit worse over time. And when, for example, some review things where people are saying, oh, that's total crap, or that's stupid, or they're even doing ad hominem attacks and so on. And because people are seeing these claims on the mailing list, I think they probably think it's okay to do this claim, but it's not. First, I must actually say, I also flame people. So I cannot say that I never flame people, and I probably sometimes, okay, I have to excuse because I'm not a native English speaker, I must say, I didn't know what I was saying. That's a trick, but other people don't have this excuse. But what I especially notice is during review, because during review, if you see some stupid code, then okay, it's good, okay to say that it's not good or even stupid code, but you don't need to go directly at the person, which I sometimes think. And what I noticed, and I even heard it privately from some people, is that it's actually because nobody's new and is not used to that one, and they're actually thinking that the people are hating them. So it's actually dangerous carrying people away. And some people are more sensitive, because basically, if you know somebody for some years, even for many years, then you know that even if they flame you, that they don't hate you. But For new people, that's much more difficult to determine. So I would hope that people are thinking twice before flaming more. But anyway, that's the flame generation. I hope it will slowly go away. Probably will not, but first of all, it's interesting to describe it. Then another generation that we have more recently now, is they call it deadline generation. That's also... okay, I'm probably idealizing it a little bit, but neural development used to be more relaxed. You didn't actually have too much deadline, and the deadlines, or whatever deadlines were there, releases or code freezes, they were usually quite unpredictable. So you never knew exactly when Linux would do a release or when it would happen or so on. And so people were actually not usually working towards states, because usually in like in closed development and so on, people usually work towards specific dates and they have very strict deadlines and so on. But it didn't used to be that in this case for mainline kernel development. But now we got the famous 2-week merge window. Basically, every time there's a release, there's a 2-week window where all the big patches are going in, and after that only code freeze or smaller patches or obvious bug fixes and so on. And first, there's still a problem. It's unpredictable when the window opens because you don't know exactly when the release will be, but you can usually guess now because it's usually an predictable schedule that every week there's an RC release and at some point there's a release. But for example, sometimes the cycles are smaller than others. For example, 2 or 6 or 20, that's much shorter. So it's going to much shorter than 6.19. But anyway, still people are working towards the deadlines here. And I have the feeling that people are a lot more pressured than they were before. So at least for me, it's, for example, because I know, okay, we are earlier at RC5, we really have to get that feature out for the next merge window, because otherwise it has to wait for 2 months or so. So you basically, then you're working a lot faster, and you're feeling the pressure, and you're starting to beat and so on. So, and also the other people are seeing this. For example, I got the impression that, okay, when you have other contributors, then I would expect that if they have more freedom, they're actually more happy. But if they don't have deadlines and so on, then they have more time to do things. But I found actually, when they have more time now. But actually, I found out that these dumb people seem to be more happy when they have deadlines. That's an interesting thing. We would expect that people are glad that they don't have specific deadlines, but actually they seem to be more, are they need a deadline, or are they used to having a deadline, or so on, I don't know. Anyway, I think that has the deadlines, or the merge windows, have changed the development quite a lot. But I say it also emphasizes a disadvantage. For example, if you're a maintainer, you're expected to send a lot of patches during the 2-week window, and it happens when you're on vacation, and you you lost the release, but then you have to do it quickly or so on. But I think it has changed the development quite a lot. Okay, the next one, that's developing generation. I call it tester generation. Actually, it's a little bit of a wishful thinking in there. So I'm hoping that it will get more and more. But traditionally, the Linux kernel, it has a specific problem because normally, like for example, when you have something like compiler or some other tool, that you can very nicely do regression tests that are static. So you have some script or some input, and always the same output comes out of it. And then you basically can find regressions very quickly and can have a nice regression test feed and so on and so on. But for the kernel, it's a lot harder because there's a lot of hardware which people don't, which the normal developers don't have. So then not only specific devices, but also, for example, there are thousands of different types of PCs, or 100,000, and all of them have usually different quirks and bugs. So you cannot often predict when you do a change. The only way to actually see if a change is good or bad is to actually throw it out to the user base and see if it works for everybody, because it basically cannot be tested statically. Of course, there are lots of bugs which can be tested by the developers. So usually they're expected to provide code that has been tested by themselves, but you have always have to do a regression test then on larger user base. And we don't, because that we normally don't have formal QA on kernel org because it would be just too hard. But the time is not enough because basically the release is every 2 months. So, and formal QA takes a long time if it's done well. And the normal model there is that instead rely on the distributions to do the bigger QA because they have more resources and more time. They have longer release schedules. But the part of the problem is just the traditional model basically that you're okay, the maintainers are doing some testing or some simple testing, and it's phoned out to the early testers who are testing a kernel before it's released, like a C kernel and so on. And then more people, when the kernel is released, are testing it, and then the bugs are getting back into stable or so on. But a problem that we had at some point is because the distribution kernels are so good now, because people often don't upgrade to the kernel log kernels or change to the kernel log kernels because they just use what was delivered on SDD and they don't change it. And so we had a little bit of a testing problem because sometimes we had the problem that a lot of bugs were only found when some big distributions did the new, the next release, because only they had enough user coverage and so on. There are some steps in this direction which are going better. For example, distributions are better now and actually pushing out kernel or kernels. So you can get RPMs of the kernel or kernels now from, I think, Fedora and SUSE has it now and some others. Probably, and that helps for testing because it makes it easier for people. They don't have to compile a kernel to actually test it. But the tester generation, okay, that was testing, but the tester generation basically is doing it. So if we're not at some point there were people who were getting more and more interested because we found, okay, you can do a lot of testing by browser people. They just boot Linux on the workstation and report if it works or not. But a lot of the things that Linux is doing cannot be easily tested on a workstation because it's well beyond what we normally do in a workstation, because workstation doesn't normally stress kernels all that much, at least in most cases. So there were people who were starting to do regression testing. There were projects like LTP and some test scripts and other things. And we actually, as I had some internal test code from distributions who started to get released. And another thing that we found out that, for example, some people were starting to do recently now is internal testing in the kernel. So for example, one thing that I realized is there was somebody bought a tool to do malloc failures. So because the kernel internally has a malloc function and it would just test, okay, does this private float when you fail some malloc and things like this. So basically, because normally when you are running, normally the kernel running, can't run the kernel normally, then you don't test error paths all that well. So you need basically inject errors to test them. And we had some people writing this code, and I think that's the developing tester generation. And I'm hoping there will be more of these people, like basically write code, write test suites, test specific stuff that does the kernel, and write internal test code and so on. And test code is not often tested through regression testing. And I see some signs of this. Like, okay, there's a lot of testing needs to be still done in, for distributions, which is bad because if the testing is done in distribution, then it's private to distribution. Okay, the bugs could usually go back to mainland at some point, but it would be much nicer to space it out over a longer time so it's done in mainline, and then when distribution does a release, it gets the already tested and better tested kernel. And of course, the people who don't want to run distribution kernels, who just get kernel or kernels, also want to have earlier QA and so on. So I'm hoping basically that we can have more testers in mainline. Another generation, I'm slowly developing, more slowly than the tester generation, what I call the bugmaster generation. And the interesting question here, when you do a release, for example, what the maintainers ask for the release managers, when they do a release, on what does it depend? Does it depend on time? No, it depends on the bugs. So how many bugs do you have? Do you have still critical bugs and so on? And it's actually quite hard to know. I think we had, at some point ago, we had a discussion on how buggy is the Linux kernel. And nobody actually knew, because we have some bug databases like Bugzilla kernel.org or distribution bugzillas and some other things. But first there's Ketat, and nobody knows, for example, how many duplicates then, how many bugs in there are dead or not dead. And then a lot of bugs actually don't get even reported to these bug databases. But basically there's no person who actually has an overview over how is the bug rate really looking. So we're actually a little bit in the dark here. We are hoping that the bug rate doesn't go up that badly. I don't think, for example, we had 10,000 bugs like Andrew Tannenbaum said, or maybe not 10,000 serious bugs, but people are running and hitting in practice. But we are not completely sure. That's the problem. So, and I think what we basically need here is people who actually like go through the bug databases and do look at them and do the various things that they need to do on the bug database. So basically. They need to look at the bug database. So what does the bug master do? Work with the bug reporters to get the basic information, because first when you get something in Bugzilla, often it's actually pretty crap, because most people don't know how to good bug report. So actually, but it's difficult because it usually gets assigned, a bug gets assigned to the maintainer, and then the maintainer has to ask the people all the information, which is a lot of strain on the maintainers. That would be good. There are actually some people who are doing this, like for example Bugzilla and kernel.org Bugzilla, who are going through bugs and asking them to provide information and so on. Another thing that's very important is tune duplicates, because most people don't check if the bug has been already reported. And it's sometimes difficult to detect the duplicate, especially if it's scattered over multiple bug databases. So, and that basically means some people who have know a lot of bugs, and even different bugs, and then can actually move the duplicates that we get. Weed out dead bugs, often bugs are dead for all releases, and nobody knows if it's still there in the latest release or not. That's our priorities. Some bugs are very obscure, some bugs are really critical. So that we actually know, for example, we have lots of critical bugs. Of course, that it's sometimes hard to say what is a critical bug or not. Usually the release managers have to decide at some point, like, but the maintainers. But it's still a lot of obvious things that can be done. Like maintainers fix the bugs, not always maintainers react to bugs quickly. That's especially a problem because traditionally, you know, kernel mainline didn't use Bugzilla. So, like, there are some projects that basically rotate around Bugzilla. For example, if you're looking at Mozilla or so on, they do everything as a bug. Or they don't even know how to write email in some cases anymore, they just write it in the bug. But for Linux, it's basically a foreign thing, a foreign language. So a lot of people don't want to have anything to do with Bugzilla, so they just ignore them, either the maintainers or the people who wrote the code. And then basically somebody send an email and ask them and what does it do, and then maybe ask somebody else and so on. Keeping track of regression, so you actually know, but it's much more worse for software projects to have a regression for a bug, basically something that you fixed already or that was working, not working anymore. That's much worse than having a new feature that just doesn't work. Because in the old release, the new feature wasn't there anyways. Okay, if it's buggy, if it doesn't work, then it's not as bad as having the old feature breaking. And it's very important to figure out if you have a release, do you have regressions, because the regressions need to be fixed. We actually have somebody checking the regressions now for releases, but it's still very much a talk, and I think he could use a lot of help and so on. And one thing I must say, a bug master doesn't need to be an expert on any kernel yet, because most of the things they're doing are pretty high-level stuff. You don't need to, for example, fix that really bug. You just need to ask them, can you give the basic information, like what kernel release you're using, or in what kernel release did this bug not happen, and things like this. Or if there's anything tricky about it, they can just always ask the maintainer or some person who is actually writing the code. And what they don't need to do, they don't need to actually fix the bug. So the bug master is not the person who fixes the bug. He just manages the bug and tells other people what bugs are around. And in general, Currently, now it's done by the release managers, but it's hard to keep track of all the stuff. So basically, know what data release is in, that how many bugs you have, and how Linux is doing. Because right now, we don't really know how buggy Linux is. And hopefully, somebody will know at some point, and I hope that will be the Bugmaster generation. And as said, there are some people who are starting to do this, but need a lot more of this. You want to become famous, now you can join a Bugmaster, or become a Bugmaster. Okay. Another one that's slowly developing, that's also some visual thinking of on my side here, this technical writer generation. Like we have some people now, for example, we have a new man page manager, and it should be actually, at least he's on the conference, I'm not sure if he is in this room. But basically, like Linux is an extremely complex project. I'm running out of time.
You're running out of time.
Okay, this generation first. And complex system needs a lot of documentation, especially internal documentation. Like, for example, you have something called kernel docs where you can write document comments on functions and so on. But and then you can actually generate PDFs out of it and get a book out of it and print it out. But one of there's no editor, so you have this interesting thing that some obscure function that actually nobody knows really needs are documented, and some really core functions are not documented. So basically, what you would need to have is some people who are doing and basically what the editor does and going over the stuff and making this actually usable, and of course maintain the main pages and perhaps in future, because Linux documentation tends to be always scattered around lots of stuff. So even for the kernel, you need to look lots of different sources to work on a great unified Linux documentation. See, okay, that's my wish. I'm not sure what will happen, but okay. Do you have enough time? Okay, I know we skipped that one. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Andy, for that.